In this hour of our show, Focus 580, we will be talking about the history of the University of Illinois. And our guest is Wynton Salberg. He is a professor emeritus of history at U of I and has written about the history of the university. He was last with us in February. We talked about the founding of the university. This morning, we'll continue the conversation talking about the years between 1894 and 1904. And he writes about them in his recent book, published last fall, I believe. It's titled University of Illinois, 1894 to 1904, The Shaping of the University. It's published by the University of Illinois Press and covers the years during which the university, as we have come to know it, really began to take shape. And I think he argues in the book that at the conclusion of this period, 1904, the U of I was really poised to make the leap from engineering college to major American university. So as we talk this morning with Professor Salberg, you certainly should feel free, if you have questions, to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Pleased to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This period between 1894 and 1904, the president of the university was a man named Andrew Draper. Tell us about him.
Yes, Draper was the president in that period. He came here as president when he was about 46 years old, I think. He was a native New Yorker. He had his only higher formal education was 1 year in a proprietary law school. He was really an aspiring and ambitious young man who identified himself with the Republican Party and all the virtues or the morality, the ethical and behavioral code of New England Puritans. As a result of his activity in Republican circles, he was made superintendent of public education in the New York State. So he's really a school superintendent. School teachers didn't like him to start with, but he did a good job, made a name for himself in that respect. Then the political wheel turned. The Democrats took over. He's out of a job. Cleveland at that time was undergoing a reform of its school system, so they invited Draper out to Cleveland to become superintendent of schools there. He was there 1 or was it 2 years? By this time, then, the university is looking for a new president, and the Board of Trustees wanted a big name. They finally decided they've got to put Illinois on the map. Draper met all of their qualifications. He's an experienced politician. He makes a good impression on people. He's bluff and domineering and aggressive. So they hired him. He set very, very high terms. He demanded a high salary. The board just fell over in enthusiasm for him. He had no experience in a college or a university, no experience with university administration. I think he failed to understand what a university or a college is like. He ran the place as if he were a military dictator or a school principal. Everybody had to have their pencils in a row and report on time, and he really depreciated teachers. He felt that they talk an awful lot and don't do anything, and they have to be kept in line. I think he was basically a poor choice. Mm-hmm. It turned out that I think he impeded the development of the university by not emphasizing the direction in which the best universities in the nation at that time are going, namely not only teaching undergraduates but developing some research capability.
One of the people apparently who was considered for president before Draper was hired was Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, Woodrow Wilson. He was a professor at Princeton at the time. The evidence would suggest that Wilson seriously thought about coming out here. He liked the political aspects. He knew he'd have to deal with the legislature, and he was, an embryonic politician at that time. But he finally declined after, I think, seriously considering it because he felt that the administrative duties would interfere too much with his capacity or opportunity to write.
Mm-hmm. I think you also note that he was when he was thinking about it, he asked people that he knew, and one of the people that he asked was Cyrus McCormick.
That's right.
Who was a friend of his and one of the trustees of Princeton.
Of Princeton.
And McCormick said, no, you don't want to go to the University.
That's,
that's like a backwater. You don't want to go down there.
Nobody in Illinois knows it or cares about it. And so, well, to a large – McCormick is in Chicago. He's a, you know, a wealthy man in Chicago. And unfortunately, that was the reputation that the University of Illinois had at that time. It had been founded as a land-grant college designed primarily to train people in engineering and agriculture. It hadn't developed awfully fast in the first 25 years. The state supported it very poorly. And McCormick was not too wrong in saying, avoid it. It's not a distinguished place.
And I think it was true at this point that most of the student body were from downstate.
They're from downstate. I've plotted that very carefully, not only downstate, but most of them are from Champaign, Urbana, or from Champaign County, or the surrounding counties in the middle of the state. Very few from southern Illinois. Gradually, the contingent from Chicago and Cook County and the northern counties begins to enlarge. But, you know, it's a small institution to start with, and agriculture hadn't taken off. The College of Agriculture is almost dead at the time Draper becomes president, and he does nothing to try to revitalize it. Mm-hmm. He hired a man, the board hired a man, namely Eugene Davenport, who came here. He found that neither Draper nor the Board of Trustees would do anything to revitalize the college. So he went over the head of the authorities to the Illinois Farmers Institute, in other words, a lobbying group, and rejuvenated the College of Agriculture over Draper's opposition. Draper fought him every inch of the way.
It was agriculture was the smallest of the four colleges.
That's right. It had eight students in it when it's almost dead.
Well, that seems to be so surprising, given the fact that it was a land grant, started as a land grant institution. The university.
Well, it's surprising in one way, but in another way, it's quite understandable. For example, there is no agricultural science yet that is sufficiently valuable to make a farmer feel that if I send my son to the university, he will gain a body of knowledge that will make this a more productive farm. Mm-hmm. That's one thing, that agricultural science doesn't really develop until the end of the century. And the second thing is that the dean of the College of Agriculture, a man named Morrow, George S.B. Morrow, was a very good propagandist, a publicist for agriculture, but he was not a very well-organized person, and the farm equipment in the farm was very, very badly run down. When Draper came, he said he looked at the total of the stock, the equipment, the barns. They were dilapidated. He found a lot of old, used models and so forth. The whole thing was worth $5 or $6. He chucked it out and so forth. So that Morrow, with all his good qualities, had not done much to promote agricultural education. And one of the trustees had made it a condition, I think a man named Napoleon B. Morrison, who owned coal mines in southern Illinois, had made it a condition with Draper that if Draper got the job, he had to get rid of Morrow.
Hmm. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Wynton Sulberg. He's professor emeritus of history at University of Illinois and has written about the history of the university and now in two books. The first, we talked a little bit about the founding of the university when he was last here in the winter. And I'm sorry to say that book is out of print, although if you're interested in reading it, you probably come up with a copy at the library. His most recent that was published last fall covers the years between 1894 and 1904, and that's published by University of Illinois Press, if you're interested in reading it. That might be a little easier to find. Questions, of course, also are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, or WILL. You do spend some time in the book talking about the trustees of the time. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that there, at this time, the only statewide office in Illinois that a woman could hold was they could be a member of the Board of Trustees of University of Illinois, and there were women on the board.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The women can only vote in school elections. Actually, in Chicago, there were people. Lucy Flower, for example, had been on the school board in Chicago. Lucy Flower is an extremely capable woman. She was married to a lawyer. She's a Republican. She's a very close ally of Draper. They work closely together. I have great admiration for Lucy Flower, even though on many issues I think she was mistaken. She followed Draper's lead much too much. She was dumped at the end of her first term because the governor at the time, Tanner, felt that she was not sufficiently loyal to his interests, which is a great loss to the university. They brought in a woman named Alice Asbury Abbott. Abbott is kind of a flake in many ways. She was a close ally of Dean Davenport. And here's a trustee who borrowed money from Davenport, and she interceded with Davenport to get things for Davenport. It's really quite improper, some of these relationships. But, you know, this is what you get. And Lucy Flower left a number of letters. They're very hard to decipher. She doesn't date them, so it's hard to fit them in place. But they're extremely valuable in her commenting on her fellow trustees. One of the members of a man who became president of the Board of Trustees for a time, she felt that he really didn't have much idea of what was going on. He needed an education, and she said she tried to give it to him as much as she could. Well, the trustees at that time, you know, are elected. Maybe that system is as good as the appointees, based on what we know in the recent events. But I think the trustees, as I've indicated, made what might be called an understandable mistake in hiring a man who looked impressive when they hired Draper. What is less understandable or forgivable is that they stayed with Draper when, if they had known what was going on, they had reason to believe that Draper was not building the university in the way it ought to be built. Mm-hmm. What was building the university, and it did grow in these years, was the effort of the leading deans of the college and the fact that all of American higher education was changing at this time, and Illinois responded to those cultural, social, intellectual developments to some extent. But part of my important theme in this book would be, I don't state this explicitly, but I think if you read the book, you'll get the point that I want to make, namely that at this crucial turning point in the development of American higher education, when the best universities are emerging to a period of eminence, Illinois lost out. And I think it's been very difficult for us to recapture that ground. Because if you lose out at a critical turning point, it's almost impossible ever to catch up. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we didn't catch up to some extent, but we seriously lost ground in that we did not become research-oriented at a time when Michigan, Berkeley, to say nothing of the new University of Chicago, Harvard, and Johns Hopkins were developing.
Well, why was there apparently this bias against or this feeling that graduate study, research, these sorts of things weren't important?
Well, it's a very good question. It's somewhat difficult to answer. I suspect that one reason is that Draper really didn't understand this. Draper felt that he kind of had a suspicion of disinterested research, that is, pure research, not knowing what practical benefits it might eventuate in. If you could prove that you were doing something that was going to grow more corn or produce more hogs, something like that, then he was okay for it. But he didn't provide any leadership in telling the board, look, this is something we must do. And the board, I think one must say, they're lay people, they're not experts in higher education, they're probably not very much in touch with educational currents throughout the nation. They didn't hold him to a higher standard. And the simple fact is that all of the deans kept pleading with him, we must have a policy, an announced policy of research, to give some impetus to those faculty members who can be encouraged to do research. They didn't get it. So that it's a combination of Draper's unwillingness, the Board of Trustees accepting what the president tells them, we simply do not get what was absolutely essential and was being achieved in other universities.
Well, this was a time when the graduate school was established. Who led that charge?
Probably Thomas Jonathan Burrell. Burrell had been here a faculty member, an extremely good botanist of a world reputation. Burrell was committed to research. He was vice president of the university. Dean Kinley, Kinley pleaded with Draper for money for research and to have research. Davenport did this. Ricker did it in architecture. And Stephen Forbes openly pleaded time and again, we must have a policy on research, but they couldn't get it. There is a graduate school, yes. It comes from within. I think Draper doesn't do really anything to encourage it. No, on the major issues, the formation, let's say, of a law school, a medical school, the library school, the graduate school, Draper does not take the initiative. He supports these things when they come. He opposed the founding of the rejuvenation of agriculture. Draper goes along with these things, but he's not the person who says, look, this is the direction we must take. I will lead you. I want your cooperation and so forth. Mm. We don't get it.
One of the things you note is that back to the Middle Ages, there always has been some conflict between universities and university communities and the towns in which
they're located,
and this was certainly no exception. What were relations like at this time between students, faculty, people who worked in the university, and people who just happened to be living in Urbana at the time?
Well, I think for the most part the relations are good. Both Champaign and Urbana were downstate. They're rural, heavily Protestant, and I think puritanical communities. There's a good deal of emphasis on religion. You must respect the Sabbath. The university doesn't let students play or use the libraries or profane the Sabbath. The university, I think, accommodates itself to the local mores, the local customs, to the largest extent. But, of course, students are students. Young people get out of hand from time to time. There is some drinking. There's no evidence that there's a lot of drinking, but the faculty is heavily against any use of alcohol. And finally, I forget exactly the year, about 1908, there was a prohibition. The temperance forces win out. But in the meantime, the students kick over the traces from time to time, and there are riots, class riots. On one occasion, sophomores who disrupt the freshman sociable, throw in tear gas or some, it's called tear gas. They blind a student. She's blinded for 2 days. Police chief of Champaign or of Urbana at the time was drunk. He's in league with the students. The mayor of Urbana had to get out a hose and turn on the students to disrupt this type of thing. This doesn't help. And, it creates a good deal of fuss. And Draper says, look, you can't do this, partly because we're dependent upon legislative appropriations, and this is going to harm our chances with Springfield.
Yeah. Well, that's something that you write about that I think it's your feeling that isn't written about very much and when people write histories either of this institution or others. And that was just how much hazing and sort of riotous behavior there was by the students.
Well, yes, let me say before I deal with hazing as such that this book covers a fairly short period, admittedly. But if I don't try to treat too many years, and this there's a certain unity to this period for reasons we've already discussed, you need some space in order to deal with topics that I think are important. Many university histories will mention that there was a problem with hazing, but you never have any idea what is the problem and why is there a problem and what happens. I've tried to spend a fair amount of time getting at this story, and the key to it is understanding that the class system that came down from the old-time college was extremely in place, very strongly in place at the turn of the century. And what this means is that you identify with your class more than with the university, and it's only gradually that university spirit comes in. These class rivalries are focused primarily on competition between the freshmen and the sophomores. Freshmen are hazed in various ways, and therefore when you get to be a sophomore, the freshmen felt that, look, they did it to me, I'm going to do it to them. Mm-hmm. And one could say that on the one hand, this is nothing but harmless college pranks. And to some extent it was. But in many ways, it's a brutal medieval custom, and it led really to serious problems. Students were accosted in their rooms. At one time, there's a group of students called Diener's Gang, Walter Diener, a kid from Chicago who was a football player. He got a group of 20 or 30 students. They went out every night of the week and would go into boarding houses and grab students and take them down to the boneyard and dunk them in. And on one occasion, a student says, "You're not going to take me," and he pulled out a revolver. They left him alone. On another occasion, there's a freshman by the name of Conard, who was a waiter in the dining hall at the time, and some sophomores said to him, "Look, it's a sophomore custom. You've got to cut off that mustache." He said, "Oh, no, my mustache is my mustache." They said, "No, it's going to go." Conard went out and got a gun. These guys jumped him when he left the dining hall one night. Several fellows jumped him. They had his scissors. They started cutting off his mustache. He shot. He shot two rounds from his gun. Now, this is not kid stuff. This is really serious stuff. And harmless pranks really led, in many cases, to brutal practices. Bullies went around evening scores with people they didn't like. And the faculty keep saying, and Draper keeps saying, "It's bad, you have to quit it, the students promised to do it." But despite Draper's gruffness and reputation for being in control, he did not get rid of hazing. When James comes in the next few years, after 1904, James dismisses a student involved in hazing summarily, and he quickly brings hazing to a conclusion. But it is, to generalize, hazing was a problem in all American colleges and universities, and here's a subject I think that needed to be taken somewhat seriously. So I give a few pages to explaining that.
Did the university have a security force at the time? Was there a university police?
There was a university policeman is hired. One university policeman is hired. I forget about this time. I forget the exact year. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, but just one?
Just one. Well, it's a fairly small institution, and the governing theory is that students are expected to behave, and only if you get out of line will you be disciplined. Mm-hmm. But there was gambling. Students went into Champagne to a gambling dens where you could drink downstairs and gamble upstairs, and the university didn't have a rule against gambling to start with. And so they said, "Well, what rule have we broken?" And my father wouldn't complain. One student says, "As long as I don't gamble, I can go there." Mm-hmm. And Burl and others, the authorities, tried to get these students to tell on others, but students had an honor code. Rarely would one student implicate another. They're very honorable in that regard.
Well, then, as now, Champagne, a den of iniquity.
Well, there were a few saloons in Urbana, too. They're mostly down Market Street and Walnut Street near the railroad station. Mm-hmm. But there were several of them.
We're a little bit, we're at a midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce again our guest. Wynton Solberg is Emeritus Professor of History at University of Illinois and has written the history of the university now in two books. The one that was published last fall deals with the period between 1894 and 1904. It's published by the U of I Press, if you would like to read it. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. When the university opened, students were required to go to chapel
right
every day. And I think that it was the beginning of this period. I think it was in 1894 that requirement was dropped.
That's correct. Right.
Why? How is it that was changed?
Well, it was enforced to start with because it was just considered, even though this is a state university, the country is still a religiously oriented country, primarily Protestant, and it's just unthinkable that you could have higher education divorced from religion. And therefore, Illinois, along with other public universities, did require chapel to start with. Chapel had finally worn out. For one thing, there's no room or chapel that is physical facility large enough to hold the student body now. Starting in the 1880s, there was one student named Foster North who said that he had no religious opinions and he would not go to chapel. The authorities kicked him out. He felt it was a violation of his rights. I think there was a growing dissatisfaction with chapel, and finally people felt that it was better to get rid of it than to keep it. So this left a vacuum, and the YMCA, or the two Y Young People's Christian Associations, the men's and the women's, fill that gap at that time. Later on, you get the rise of the religious foundations around the campus, but that comes somewhat later than the period I'm writing about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that also this, partly, I guess, because of that, that people on the university at this point felt that there needed to be things to for the students to identify with, to organize school spirit around. So this was the time when you start to have school songs. And in fact, previous to around this point, there were no official colors. This is when navy blue and orange become officially the colors of the university.
That's right. Well, that's part of the attempt to overcome class spirit and emphasize university spirit. But at the in 1894, I think, so when the students came here, they had picked up the notion that when you go to college, you're part of a class of 1900, let's say. And that old feeling is very, very strong, because in the old-time college, a given class had studied all the same subjects together, and they really did identify very strongly with the students that they had entered and would graduate with. Now there's a conscious attempt to the Board of Trustees wants to create a university. That's why they bring in Draper. We start getting professional schools. And the students began to realize that we do need to have university spirit. So, yes, you get school colors. And the orange and blue are popularly devised. Then we get school yells. And you get school songs. One of the other things that I think is a bond of unity is religion. University is overwhelmingly a Protestant institution at this time, and I've worked out how this plays out in detail. Namely, it's primarily the student body is primarily Methodist. After Methodists, the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, small number of so a lot of Baptists, a small number of Episcopalians, Unitarians, and Catholics. I think in this university, over 50% in 1894, over 50% of the student body are members of churches. But that's less than in the universities, state universities around us, Indiana, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, and so forth. The YMCA is a an extremely important agency in promoting religious belief at the time. I think about 35% of the student body are members of men are members of the YMCA, and 42% or something like that of the women. If you translated that into present day terms, you'd have thousands of students on the campus who are members of the Y. Obviously, things have changed a good deal, but the Y runs a number of programs. Probably the most important would be a Bible study program in which students signed up to take courses in Bible, studying the Bible. Illinois had the highest percentage of its students involved in Bible study at the turn of the century of any universities in North America, including Canada. The piety is really somewhat overwhelming, or religiosity, if you like. And the faculty, many leaders of the faculty speak at the YMCA. They are advisors to the YMCA. They give speeches. Kinley, a later president of the university, talked about the notion of God in the Bible. Burl, a botanist, a devoted Methodist, gave a series of lectures on creative evolution. E.B. Green, the a historian who became dean of the College of Literature and Arts, who is of the son of a congregational missionary out in Japan. He had grown up in Japan. He spoke on, I forget what topic, characters in the Bible or something like that. Leading faculty members are closely identified with Christianity. There are very few Protestants or Catholics and Jews at this time, but they are present. I've written about those in articles that have been published, and they will figure more prominently in the book that I'm working on now when we get on this campus. The strongest Catholic foundation, now Newman Hall, the strongest Wesley Foundation, which begins here, and Hillel, which begins on this campus. It's really quite a remarkable achievement.
Pardon the triviality, but I'm curious about the issue of the school colors, how it is that those colors were arrived upon, was that supposed to represent someone, something? Did someone just think that they were a pleasant combination of colors?
Well, actually, I don't include in this book the reason for that, because, you know, I had a much longer manuscript, and to keep it manageable, I had to cut that out. Draper was a very strong believer in William and Mary, the Protestants from the Netherlands who took over. The blue represents the color of steadfast faith, and the orange is the colors that had been put down at the Battle of the Boyne. And so he offers a long description in which he talks about the significance of the blue and the orange.
So he suggested blue and orange.
No, I don't think he's the one to suggest it. A committee from the Athletic Association met with a student committee. They came up with the blue and the orange. I suppose Draper had a hand in this. Mm-hmm. Then Draper presented it to students at a convocation. The students unanimously or overwhelmingly said, yes, these are our colors. And all of a sudden, then you have the blue and the orange. Navy blue and orange.
I think it's not quite the orange and blue that we have now. I don't imagine the orange would have glowed in the dark the way that the current ones do.
Well, I think today we've worked out some chemical formula as to what the colors must be, and I don't think they were quite that careful at the time. But
This was also a time, I think, that when there was a significant growth in fraternities and Greek life on the campus.
That's quite true. In the 19th century, the fraternities had started in the early 19th century as social organizations, but the predominant student groups in the 19th century were literary societies, which were designed to give students an opportunity to deal with current political, social, intellectual issues that you didn't get in the classroom at the time. So the literary societies enroll intellectually, academically oriented students, and they're very prominent. Now, at the end of the 19th century, the social fraternity begins to come in, and Illinois, in the period that I'm writing about here, at the turn of the century, begins to be a leading center for fraternities among American universities. And there are a number of reasons for that. We're not a large city, and therefore you have a problem of housing and feeding students at a time when the university accepts no responsibility for having dormitories and has only begrudgingly and lately, late in arriving at establishing a dining hall. So from the university's standpoint, it's great to have fraternities because you help solve your problem of feeding and housing students. Students want social activities. Therefore, the fraternities began to grow on this campus very, very quickly, starting in after there had been a ban on fraternities down to the 1890s. Hmm. And President Peabody, who was in office from 1880 to 1891, had been totally against fraternities as divisive. It's not what you go to universities for, to engage in these social activities. That ban now is lifted, and the fraternities quickly grow. Then from the standpoint of the dean of students, Thomas Arkell Clark, who becomes the first dean of students in an American university in 1901, he's Draper's favorite. Draper encouraged him a good deal and treated him much, much more generously than other members of the faculty. Clark was extremely able in dealing with young men. But from Clark's standpoint, if you have students organized in groups, it's easier to control them than if you're dealing with them as isolated individuals. So suddenly fraternities provide a need. From the university standpoint, they solve certain problems. From the student standpoint, they solve certain problems. And then with the rise of the fraternity or sorority house, students now, it used to be in the older days, fraternities were not very divisive because if you belonged to a fraternity, you didn't have a separate house. You met in university rooms or college rooms once or twice a week or several times a month, whatever it was. But you were not separated from the student body as much as you might be when you get your own house. Mm-hmm. Now that you get your own houses, these houses become rather exclusive preserves. They want to have a tremendous amount of social activity. So fraternities quickly become divisive within the university. There's an old feeling that the distinction among students between so-called barbarians and Greeks, that is the independent students who don't belong to fraternities, and they have a much harder time making their way socially in the university. They don't have as much fun and games. They don't get elected to offices quickly because they don't have a built-in support system. So I think there's no question but that fraternities introduce an undemocratic and divisive element into university culture.
We are moving into about our last 10 minutes of this part of Focus 580 with U of I Professor Emeritus of History, Wynton Salberg. We're talking about the history of the university. He's written about it and now two books and is working on a third. The one that's available now covers the years from 1894 to 1904 and published by the University of Illinois Press. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. A thought comes to mind when you talked about the fact that before fraternities, there were literary societies where people could get together and talk about various sorts of things, including issues of the day. Was it the case, so I sort of had this right, that the university administration really shied away from being involved in politics, having controversial issues discussed, that it was just something that they thought they didn't want really to be involved with?
Very much so. This goes back to that question, a point you raised earlier about town gown conflicts over the years. What had happened in the late 19th century, for a time, students were very involved in politics. They brought political rallies and demonstrations to the campus, and this tended to get out of hand. There was some violence connected with these in the 1880s, and it was disadvantageous to the university for students to be closely identified with one political party, because the other political party then would feel, well, what's going on over at the university? So in the very mid-1890s, the university decides to solve this problem by saying there cannot be any political activity on the campus. You can't bring political candidates onto the campus. You can't have political speeches on the campus. It's an understandable response to a real problem. But I argue in my book, and I think it's also true, that this tends to keep students isolated from responsibilities of a citizen. Mm-hmm. And it's not until, I think, in the 1960s sometime that policy has changed and a political candidate can come on the campus. I arrived here in 1961, and as I recall, there was Nixon or Kennedy. I've seen various presidential candidates on the campus, but it could not have been done for the years from the late 19th century well into the 20th century.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start in Champaign with line one. Hello.
Hello, Professor Salberg. I was wanting to ask, and I'm not sure that it actually falls into the period we're discussing, but where the impetus came for the creation of the library that is now such the boast of the university. Where did this idea come from to really attract a world-class library to Champaign-Urbana?
I think the impetus comes primarily from President James. James arrived in 1904. James, quite different from our earlier presidents, he was a native of Illinois, but he had gone to Germany to get a doctorate in political economy, so he knew what a German university was like. And when he became president here in 1904, he had a vision which almost staggers the imagination. He said, we really want to create a world-class university here. Why not? Yes, it's downstate, it's a small community, but so was Cambridge, England at one time. If you're going to have a world-class university, you have to have a world-class faculty, and that faculty must have a world-class library. Lacking other libraries in a city like Chicago, we have to build a library here. So it's James, to the largest extent, that goes to the legislature, brings in a new librarian, Phineas Windsor, and the collection development becomes the great drive in the library starting in about 1909-12, around there.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll go next to an Urbana caller here, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have some photographs that my grandparents took. They graduated in New York State at 1900 and 1904, and I just had some questions about when you were talking about the class rivalry.
Right.
I have a picture of my grandmother in her basketball uniform that says 04 on it at Cornell. And I was just wondering, is this an intramural kind of sports activity, or would they have been playing against somebody else? It doesn't say Cornell on it.
It was both. It was here at Illinois, at any rate. We have a women's basketball team starting in about 1897. I forget the exact date. But women's basketball gets started before men's basketball, which comes in about 1906, I think. And the women's team, they had six players, as I recall. They did play other colleges. I think our team played Illinois Wesleyan. So they were both intramural and intercollegiate women's basketball at that time.
Okay. Thank you. Another question is, I have photographs of my grandfather wearing what looks like some sort of military uniform, but I don't believe he was in the military at that time. Was there some kind of movement in the universities at the turn of the century?
Oh, very definitely. It's a very good point. The university... The Land-Grant Act, the act establishing the Land-Grant Colleges, said you must offer military training. It doesn't say every student has to take it, but the law became interpreted in that way. And the original Board of Trustees really wanted to make Illinois a miniature West Point. An Army officer is delegated to come as the professor of military tactics, and there is a student military detachment, a regiment, I think, and the band that develops is originally a cornet band designed to aid in the military formations, so that the military unit is extremely prominent in the university from the very beginning, well into the 20th century.
Okay, thank you. That's very interesting.
All right, and thank you. We'll continue, and we'll go here to Terre Haute, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering when the women were first admitted to the University of Illinois or its predecessor.
Well, the university opens in 1868, founded in 1867, and if I remember correctly, women are introduced in 1871, very quickly, but not from the very, very beginning. In the period in which I am writing, women have not yet become very numerous in the university. I think there are about 13% women in the student body in 1894 because we're largely an engineering school, and women are not notorious for studying engineering at that time. There's a conscious effort to adapt the curriculum to women, and gradually the number of women does increase, but it's not large to start with.
Were there any other women's issues on campus during the period that you're writing about?
I don't know what you mean by women's issues, but if I can interpret your question in one way, a woman's issue is that it's felt that women coming to a university or a small town in which there are no dormitories for women have an unusually difficult time taking care of the problems of finding suitable housing and a place to eat. That's a woman's issue, I think. And there is a committee on the welfare of women, of the trustees. The two women trustees and one man are on that committee. Draper, in hiring, Draper appoints a woman's dean or a dean of women. And he says in getting a dean of women, he doesn't want some woman who feels that she has to argue all these controverted questions. In other words, he doesn't want a feminist. But he does want a woman who will look out for the needs of women. That's a woman's issue, I think. Can you think of others
What about, like, WCTU? Or do they have a chapter on campus? Women's Christian Temperance Union?
No, there's the temperance forces are not gender distinct at that time. The temperance forces are led by faculty members and townspeople, but I don't know that any women as such are identified with them. Their names don't come through. But I don't think there's any chapter of the WCTU at this time, at least not that I'm aware of.
How about women's suffrage? Was there active activities about that on campus?
No, I think it's I'm not aware of this at all. That it probably just accepted the fact that women can't vote except in school elections in the state of Illinois. And I don't know of any agitation for women's suffrage in the period about which I write in the recent book.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to have you talk at least a little bit about athletics just before we got going. We talked about the fact that it's something that we have a lot of debate about today, what the place of athletics on the campus should be and whether it's appropriate for universities to have big-time sports programs. That even apparently at this point, people were concerned about whether there was too much emphasis being placed on sports.
Well, it's a nice open-ended question. How much emphasis is too much emphasis? I start a chapter on the rise of intercollegiate athletics by quoting George Santayana, in which he points out that athletics are an essential human activity, but they have no necessary relation to higher education. And I think it's quite true that young people want to play games. In England, young people played games for the fun of it. In the United States, what happens in American higher education is that gradually one plays to win. You don't play just for the fun of it. You play to win. And at this time, many universities are fairly new. Illinois is a new university, and they feel that athletics will advertise the university. Harper, up at president of the University of Chicago, was notorious for that. He hired a coach named Stagg, and he said, I want you to win. I don't care if you have to crush other people to do it, but win, and we'll give you a palace car and preferred treatment if you win games. We take over that attitude. Namely, if you have winning football teams, they're going to know who you are. So football now replaces baseball as the leading college sport. And football quickly then becomes, if you're determined to win, it's necessary on occasion to cheat. And if you're going to win, you have to get the best coach. And what happens is that athletics quickly becomes commercialized and corrupted, I think. And it's almost impossible to govern it. So that by the end of the century, it's perfectly clear that athletics is going to be here. You can't totally curb it. Students want it. The public wants to be entertained. The newspapers, the media are going to sell papers by publicizing these things. It's an irresistible force, but it quickly becomes brutal. And President Elliott of Harvard points out that it leads to all sorts of untoward values in American life. It ought to be abolished, but he loses out. Everybody loses out who wants to abolish football. It's here to stay, and it can't easily be tamed.
Well, there, for the moment, we'll have to stop. We've used the time. Thanks very much.
I'm glad to have done it.
Wenton Zollberg is Emeritus Professor of History at University of Illinois. His book, if you'd like to read it, The University of Illinois, 1894 to 1904, The Shaping of the University, published by U of I Press.